Hey there, friends. A quick favor. We are conducting a brief audience survey. We'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes to provide your answers. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to complete it. That's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you. As millions in Texas go without power during a bitter cold snap, parts of Mexico are also hurting, raising questions about outages and a shared grid.
The whole North American energy supply grid is totally integrated.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, this week marks the first step toward allowing in migrants stuck at the U.S.-Mexico border, but not everyone will be included.
We have really serious concerns about the number of people who are going to be left out of this process.
And Facebook is getting slammed in Australia for a sudden news ban on its platform.
You, Mr. Zuckerberg, are behaving exactly like a cyber bully.
From news blackouts to power outages, those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us this Thursday. Snow here in Boston today, still cold throughout much of the U.S., but it's power outages and natural gas shortages that continue to pummel Texas. That's weighing heavy for many people. Much of northern Mexico is also struggling without power this week, in homes, hospitals, and the factories that produce lots of goods for the U.S. I've got The World's Jorge Valencia on the line from Mexico City to help us understand just how much the two countries' power grids are interconnected. Jorge, explain how these outages have extended all the way down to Mexico. Have residents in the capital experienced any of this?
Well, Marco, there have been some reports of outages here in the capital area, and these natural gas shortages have had ripple effects throughout most of Mexico. But really, the area that is primarily affected is northern Mexico, in particular, the four states that are on the other side of Texas. And that includes thousands of factories, or maquiladoras, as they're referred to here, that produce goods for the United States. I spoke with Rosalinda Torres. She is the director of operations at Inteva, which is a company that produces car panels and armrests for car manufacturers in the United States. And at first, we just talked about her situation at home.
Bueno, it's not good. You know, the house starts getting pretty cold. Some people like to heat up the house with something else, but it's sometimes dangerous. So it's better just to use layers and warm up yourself with blankets and things like that.
Torres says that the three factories that her company has have been offline since Monday, and she says it's not only because of the lack of electricity.
Exactly. In addition to that, the natural gas is right now being limited. We have heat treatment ovens. We have curing ovens for our paint processes. So we do need gas for our processes.
Marco, just in Matamoros alone, that's across the border from Brownsville, just in Matamoros alone, a local industry group estimates that some 85 to 90,000 workers have not been working since Monday as a result of these outages.
So, Jorge, this sounds a lot like what we heard from Texas all week. Are the two countries, are the state of Texas, I should say, and Mexico, are they operating off the same source of energy?
To a great extent, yes, because Mexico is very much a client of the United States and of Texas in particular. To better understand this, I spoke with Jorge Piñon. He directs the Center for International Energy Policy at the University of Texas at Austin.
By the way, it's not only between Texas and Mexico. Also, Canada is involved. The whole North American energy supply grid or system, whether it's liquid fuels, electricity, crude oil, is totally integrated.
Marco, if there's one number that I want to share with you that I hope you'll take away from this, it is 40%. The figures vary slightly on this, but it is estimated that roughly 40% of Mexico's electricity production is fueled by natural gas that is being piped in from Texas.
That's enormous reliance. And I see Governor Greg Abbott of Texas signed an order barring the export of natural gas. So how does that affect Mexico, and what kind of political debate is that creating?
Well, Marco, that order, the temperatures are still very cold in Texas, and the natural gas isn't even getting to the people who need it in Texas. So these companies wouldn't even be able to export them to Mexico or to anywhere else, no matter how much they wanted to. But it's also possible that this will generate or renew a conversation about hydraulic fracturing here in Mexico, because Mexico, unlike the United States, does not allow hydraulic fracturing. But there are people who point out if that natural gas were being extracted, then Mexico could be less reliant on the United States. So certainly this is something that is sure to renew debates over energy policy here in Mexico, at least for some time.
The World's Jorge Valencia joining us from Mexico City. Thank you very much for explaining this, Jorge.
You're welcome, Marco.
We're staying in Mexico for this next story about the reversal of a signature Trump-era program that kept tens of thousands of migrants from entering the U.S., a program known as Remain in Mexico. The World's Monica Campbell has more.
It was freezing when I checked in with Imelda Lemos this week.
Un poquito de frío, pero estamos bien.
I could tell she was shivering. She and her daughter Nidia are asylum seekers from Guatemala, and for 17 months they've lived in a tent in Matamoros, Mexico, just across the border from Texas. The freezing weather has been like a final test. There are no heaters, just blankets. Lemos sent me a picture of an outdoor water spigot they use, draped with icicles. But she's hopeful. Change is close.
Emocionada. Dijo que no se iban a permitir pasar.
We're excited, she says, because Lemos might soon get the green light to enter the U.S. Then it's on to the next stop.
Nueva Jersey.
New Jersey, where Lemos' youngest daughter lives. Historically, people have the right to seek asylum in the U.S., even if they enter without permission. The Trump administration stopped that, though, arguing without evidence that more migrants were telling fake stories to get in. So when Lemos and her daughter reached the border and explained how an armed group had forced them off their land in Guatemala, they were told to wait out their U.S. court case in Mexico under Trump's Migrant Protection Protocols, also known as the Remain in Mexico program. Now, President Joe Biden is undoing it, and that's a relief for migrants and immigration lawyers like Lindy Tozlowski in California.
We're talking about a population that for the last 2 years has been put under such incredibly desperate situations at the border, in really dangerous conditions, in camps and shelters in the northern border cities.
Tomorrow, officials will slowly begin registering the 25,000 or so migrants with active cases. There are people from all over the world. Most are Hondurans, Guatemalans, and Cubans, ranging from infants to the elderly. Once in the U.S., many will stay with family and have court dates. But tens of thousands of other migrants put into Trump's program are excluded from this first phase. People who might have pending appeals or perhaps lost their case because they were navigating a complicated system from Mexico without a lawyer or even a phone in some cases.
We have really serious concerns about the number of people who are going to be left out of this process.
Many people put in Trump's program couldn't wait any longer at the border with small kids, through extreme weather, and facing danger like kidnapping and assault. Migrants are big business for criminal groups.
Hola.
Hola, Karina.
¿Qué tal, sí?
Karina Gutierrez once stayed in a tent for months with her six-year-old boy, just near Imelda Lemos' tent. Gutierrez says she left Honduras after she was raped and the police wouldn't protect her. Her asylum case was denied and she appealed. But then she was told she'd have to wait another 6 months to see a judge. She left the border with her boy, and they're back in Honduras. She's wondering if they'll have another shot at asylum.
Y me dieron la oportunidad, pues. Pero no sé si se podrá. No sé si alguna vez yo... Bueno, si yo volviera a entrar otra vez.
I'd like another opportunity, she says, but she doesn't know if that'll be possible. Not yet. The Biden administration is also telling migrants who aren't part of the Remain in Mexico program to wait. Here's White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki at a recent briefing.
We continue to convey that this is not the time to come.
But Imelda Lemos, who will soon have her asylum case heard, hopes that the Biden administration will give other migrants a chance to make their case too.
Yo lo que pido que el presidente de Estados Unidos escuchar, porque nosotros no fuimos escuchados, a nosotros no nos escucharon.
I hope the president takes the time to listen to why people are leaving, she says, because we were not heard by the Trump administration. Nobody listened to us. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
Coming up in a few minutes, President Biden today unveiled the details of his plans and proposed changes to overhaul the immigration system. More on that just ahead. If you're in Australia and log on to Facebook today, you'll notice a big change, a total news blackout. Media groups in the country are no longer allowed to post their content to the site, and Facebook users in Australia can no longer share articles from the site. Facebook issued the news bans in response to legislation that would force it to pay news groups to feature their content. It's left a lot of people in Australia staring at blank screens. The World's Lydia Manalidou has our story.
Here's what it looks like to log onto Australian Facebook today.
If you're an Australian and you try to post a link to a news story, it doesn't work. You get an error message.
Justin Warren is a consultant in Melbourne.
If you go to the page for certain news organisations, then on those pages, you will see no content. Facebook basically says no posts yet. It's like it's a brand new page.
Even if you're in another country, like in the US, and you try to look up an Australian media organization on Facebook, you'll see the same thing. Facebook took this unprecedented step of imposing a news ban in the midst of heated negotiations with Australian lawmakers. They are pushing legislation that would force Facebook to pay news outlets for content on its site. Facebook really doesn't want to do this.
Clearly, Facebook is trying to bully the Australian Parliament into only approving laws that it approves of.
This is Matt Canavan, a senator with Australia's Nationals Party, during a TV interview. He said Facebook is trying to make an example out of Australia.
What they're really worried about is if this works in Australia, it'll come in the US, in Canada, in India, in Europe, and suddenly they've actually had to pay proper rates for the content they've been using right around the world.
Facebook argues that publishers already get benefits from posting on Facebook, like reaching new audiences and getting new subscribers. Google, which initially said it would pull its search engine from Australia over the legislation, has since made a complete U-turn. It struck up agreements to pay several big publishers. But Facebook remains opposed.
You, Mr. Zuckerberg, are behaving exactly like a cyber bully.
Neil Mitchell hosts a morning radio show in Melbourne. In this video message to Facebook's CEO posted on Twitter, Mitchell accused Facebook of trying to punish Australians, and he called the company's moves
really quite outrageous. Okay, fiddle with my Facebook page and censor it, that really doesn't matter. But you've been cutting off vital information from emergency services, the fire services. Domestic violence services.
Mitchell is talking about the dozens of government, NGO, and other Facebook pages that were also swept up in this news wipe over the last 24 hours.
You've even cut off the Weather Bureau, for heaven's sake. Why?
If it's ignorance or malice, I think time will tell.
Lucy Kraholtseva is with Digital Rights Watch, an Australian nonprofit whose Facebook page was also affected. She says some of this was probably an accident, but that this was also a way for Facebook to flex its muscles.
Because they actually wanted to try and make a point.
A point of showing what could happen if the law passes. A Facebook spokesperson told me in a statement that the company took a broad definition on what constitutes as news content in order to respect the law as drafted. And they said they would reverse any pages that were inadvertently impacted. Kraholtseva says while she questions Facebook's intentions, the Australian government hasn't really been acting in good faith with this legislation either.
The fact that they are now focusing on this is about public interest journalism is a real scapegoat.
She and other critics say the way the law was drafted favors big conglomerates and not smaller, independent, local publishers that could benefit from agreements with Google and Facebook. And she criticized the government for throwing all its weight behind this proposal when there are other issues like codifying privacy protections that it desperately needs to address. For The World, I'm Lydia Manalidou.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. President Joe Biden has been in office roughly 4 weeks. On day one, he started undoing several Trump-era immigration restrictions. Today, his administration is rolling out a sweeping immigration proposal. To go over this dramatic turn in policy, Cristobal Ramon in Washington joins me. He's an immigration policy consultant. Cristobal, this plan covers a lot of ground. For you, what are some of the big takeaways that make this different from past immigration plans?
For me, the biggest takeaway is that the Biden administration is definitely focusing on trying to manage migration from Central America to the U.S.-Mexico border, which is to say he's finding different ways to ensure that you don't have a lot of folks coming to the U.S.-Mexico border, but you're able to do this humanely instead of trying to use a deterrence strategy like what we saw with the Trump administration, trying to keep people from coming in. You know, in specifics, there is international aid, which is what you've seen in past CIR efforts, comprehensive immigration reform bills. But I think what's more interesting is that he is trying to update the border enforcement system at the U.S.-Mexico border to be able to accommodate different kinds of individuals, including asylum seekers.
I mean, there's some good immediate news in this plan, green cards for farm workers and people with temporary protected status and young people who arrived in the U.S. as kids, the dreamers, so-called. The plan wants to reduce pressure at the border also by setting up refugee processing centers in Central America. You kind of leaned into that. How has this worked in the past?
You know, the Obama administration set up the Central American Migrants Program. And when it back in 2015 or 2016, there was some evidence it worked, but I think the key issue is because it was so short-lived that we don't really fully have the full picture of as to how it could deal with a broader, larger population aside from unaccompanied minors. So I think, for instance, some things to consider is if it takes a while for an individual to have their asylum case processed in region, at what point does the individual say, you know what, I think I'm going to take my chances and try to get asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border because this is taking too long. So I think considerations like that are things that you need to think about as you're setting up these types of plans.
I mean, one big question is it realistic to expect people fleeing danger at home to stay in place and wait for a response from the U.S.?
That's the central problem. Because I think if you look at reporting on why people flee, you know, you see people who are, for instance, in Guatemala who might be coming from the Guatemalan highlands, maybe will move to Guatemala City. And once they're in Guatemala City, they're realizing, well, I didn't have an economic opportunity in the highlands. The government officials here are corrupt and won't address my concerns about violence. I'm just going to move to the United States. And so if you try to do in-region processing, I think one of the challenges is I'm not that far away from the sources of danger that I fled from. So I think that that's a really important challenge is how do you be able to provide for the human security of these individuals in region processing? Because it is very important that they feel secure in order for this plan to work.
Yeah, another part of the regional management here with this proposal, the bill proposes $4 billion to address corruption and boost economic development in Central America. I mean, that has been tried before. What do you make of it this time? And is $4 billion over 4 years enough to make a difference?
If this administration wants to do something right with assistance and targeting corruption and economic development in Central America, it has to consider two things. First and foremost, I think you're looking at a lot of studies that show that actually international aid and development actually increases migration because people have more resources to be able to contract a smuggler and go to the U.S.-Mexico border. The other thing to consider is also studies also show that with development aid, if it's intentionally set out to target and deter immigrants from leaving the region, there isn't enough evidence to really show that that's the case. What you see experts suggesting is that let's target the conditions, and one of the side effects might be fewer people who are leaving. So if the administration wants to be able to do this right when it comes to actually implementing this aid, it needs to keep these two things into consideration.
Cristobal, let's talk about how this is going to happen, because Biden has said he's flexible with how this immigration plan is carried out. It could mean breaking it into smaller bills. What approach makes sense from this standpoint if Biden wants to have a chance at pushing anything through?
This is a really complex problem because, you know, if you have multiple trains leaving the station, which one do you hitch your wagon to, right? I think it is good that they're trying to make an effort to at least give a good faith effort to pass the U.S. Citizenship Act, you know, this big, broad reform bill. I think the question is, at what point do they say, this is taking a little bit too long, let's just simply go for the smaller bills? And I think that that's where there's just this confusion as to what's going to be able to move first. Are we going to move the Citizenship Act and then pivot immediately to these smaller bills? Are we going to give it maybe the Citizenship Act more time and then pivot? I think that those are sort of the logistical things to consider.
The GOP, as you know, places high value on border security. What kind of increased border security are Republicans looking for right now? And is there anything like that in this proposal?
What Republicans are looking for, you know, are significantly more resources in, for instance, with CBP personnel. I think looking a lot more at fencing, whether you want to call that the wall or not, they're looking at that. So those are some things that they want on the border. But I think where the GOP is, to be honest, is their view, or at least some of their members, think that the reason the crisis occurred in the first place is that people were coming in here with fraudulent cases for asylum and then were left into, you know, to leave into the United States where they would, quote unquote, disappear. So I think that the sense is Republicans don't see this bill as having enough enforcement and doesn't address the root causes of the migration crisis as they see it.
So as you think about the people that these changes could impact, what do you think Biden ought to do politically to get his package over the finish line? Like, how much compromise is too much?
At a certain point, the question is, how do you get to 60 votes in the Senate? And I think that is the bottom line. How do you get to 60 votes in the Senate? And I think Biden's going to have to do that, obviously, with Republican votes. And in order to do that, I think Biden needs to acknowledge the fact that although immigration advocates on the left have been pushing him to do a lot of policies that reflect their priorities, at a certain point, Biden has to recognize that the Immigration Reform Act effort expands beyond the left. It expands to the center and to the center right.
That's Cristobal Ramon, an immigration policy consultant, speaking with us from Washington. Cristobal, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to make note of a mistake yesterday during our interview about escalating tensions between Kurds and Turkish authorities. In describing a roundup of people detained in connection to the murder of Turkish officers, I said that there had been more than 700 Kurds arrested. We do not know, in fact, that they are all Kurdish. I should have said more than 700 people were detained. For more on this story, visit theworld.org. The World keeps on spinning. Our team of editors and reporters can help you make sense of the latest headlines and catch up with today's stories from Ethiopia to Mexico, France to Japan. At theworld.org, you'll find it all. Again, that's theworld.org. Marco here. We were blown away by the support we received during our 2020 fundraiser. Over 1,000 listeners made donations to support The World. People like Susan Fuller, Neil Richardson, Penelope Laugham, Martha Eisler-Hardin, Diana Schmidt, AF, just initials, Jeremy Levine, Kathleen Inman, Ron Kemp, and Anand Chokalingam. Thank you all. You guys rule. Even though I'm unable to thank each person who donated, know that here at The World, we are forever grateful for every single one of you who continues to listen to the show. In France, the Me Too movement stalled out, but it's now being revived.
It was just sort of finally, this moment came. I've been waiting for this for so long.
And this second wave has a focus the first one did not. That's coming up ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. People in northern Ethiopia's Tigray region have been enduring a military conflict for 4 months now. Tens of thousands have fled over the border to Sudan to escape the fighting. Communications in and out of Tigray had been cut off but are now starting to come back, and we're learning more about some of the reported atrocities there. At the same time, other parts of Ethiopia are also dealing with flare-ups of ethnic violence. Around the world, the Ethiopian diaspora has watched this conflict intensify and tried to make sense of their personal stories against a backdrop of this fight. That includes Mekli Tadero. She's an Ethiopian-American musician and culture activist and a friend of the show. We featured her stories about the lives and work of immigrant musicians, part of her project called Movement. Mekli, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
So you came to the U.S. when you were about two. Music has been a culture connector and a touchstone for you. How has it also helped you understand the ethnic divides in Ethiopia?
Well, when I was growing up, my experience of Ethiopian culture was really filtered through the lives and memories and stories of my parents. But that's just two people, and we're talking about a country with over 100 million people. So in 2009, I founded a collective of Ethiopian diaspora artists called the Arba Munch Collective. And we would go to Ethiopia together to connect with culture makers there. We went to southern Ethiopia, to the city of Arba Munch. And we were immersed in a world of diversity that I had never known around Ethiopian culture before. The south of Ethiopia has over 56 ethnic tribes alone, and they all have their own music and dancing culture. And so on that trip, for example, we learned that the traditional food there, it's not injera and what, it's like a fermented root of the false banana tree, which is totally different than what I had experienced growing up. So on that trip in particular, just was a lens into what the real vast ethnic diversity of Ethiopia really is.
So that most recent trip to Ethiopia, the one we're about to hear from, that was before the fighting in Tigray broke out. Before we hear what you discovered this time back, I'd like to know how you've been absorbing and processing some of these horror stories coming out of Tigray, considering your focus is on the culture of your country.
Well, it's a time of heartbreak for many Ethiopians. It's a time of tragedy. You know, hearing these stories of suffering is just, it's just absolutely tragic. At the same time, you know, there are folks on the ground who are doing the work of building togetherness and unity. For me, what I'm really inspired by is the way musicians are doing this every single day. And it's hard work, and sometimes it's overwhelming work, and sometimes it all feels impossible. But it's a path forward that artists have. It's our way as artists. And so this was the story I wanted to tell.
Well, McLee, thank you for setting things up. Let's hear what you found out when you were last in Ethiopia and some of the things you're hearing today.
This is a story torn in two. It's about a country on a precipice. My country, Ethiopia. I travel back there every year or two to perform or visit family, or at least I did before the pandemic. But my last trip in 2019 was a very different kind of experience because the country was smack in the middle of a historic and for many, a joyous transition. In April of 2018, a new prime minister, a man by the name of Abiy Ahmed, came into power, and it was this watershed moment.
After 6 weeks of uncertainty, Dr. Abiy Ahmed was elected as the new head of the...
You know, my family obsessively watches Ethiopian news on YouTube.
So, what do we know about him?
So, I knew that Prime Minister Abiy had all of these amazing reforms that were happening.
The judicial system, in the security system.
There was the peace with Eritrea.
In ending a long military standoff.
The fact that the prime minister named half of his cabinet as women,
including in charge of the defense ministry,
that he lifted restrictions on the press. So this was a time not just of transition, but of transformation.
Reforms in Ethiopia.
But knowing all of that from social media and the news while far away in another country, it's very different from experiencing it on the ground in Ethiopia. So it's 2019, my last trip to Ethiopia. Me and my band have just arrived, totally jet-lagged in the capital, Addis Ababa. And that first night, we walked over to one of my cornerstone spots of Addis, which is Fendiga. It's part music venue, part bar, part cultural center, all vibe.
I am now the age of 43. I never felt like this.
This is Malaku Balai, a dancer, choreographer, and the owner of Fendiga.
I see the situation now, and I'm blessed in my life this time.
At this moment, it feels absolutely right, because what you've been...
This is my friend, Sammy Yerga, who's a celebrated Ethio jazz pianist.
What I've been trying to describe Ethiopia for the rest of the world, is making sense now.
You have to understand that for Ethiopians like Malaku and Sammy, this country had been under some form of oppressive government their whole lives, really since the 1970s. And so when Abiy became prime minister in 2018 and began instituting reforms, it was like suddenly living in technicolor.
What was going on? So I'm so happy to be here.
Meheret Kabeda is a poet and an arts organizer.
The change in Seoul. So I can see some opening, some kind of light that I can enter into.
At that moment 2 years ago, many folks in Ethiopia were walking around with a sense that history was being made. But even then, there was a kind of specter that haunted the hope. The path to peace and unity, it felt slim and steep. The risk of war, fragmentation, ethnic violence, they were palpable. And the person who voiced that potential most clearly was another friend of mine, a jazz musician named Jorka Musfin, who, like me, has found his voice by moving back and forth between countries.
So I've been a musician since I was 16. I started my professional career in the U.S.
Jorka left Ethiopia when he was 14. He spent 2 years in New Delhi, India. After that, he made his way to Greensboro, North Carolina, then Atlanta, New York City, and finally, at the age of 30, he returned home to Ethiopia.
And I've been back in Ethiopia for 12 years now.
Jorka moved back to Ethiopia because he wanted to contribute to the changes happening in the country, as well as the changes happening in Ethiopian jazz. These goals are really linked in his mind, so to understand how Jorka thinks about social change, it helps to understand how he thinks about music.
How would you describe Ethio jazz to someone who's never heard it before?
You know, I think it's like it has its ear on the American jazz, like it has heroes. But I think Ethio jazz was created outside that racist society. So it's very human and softer. Like the music that happened at the same time the US had was like Black Power, it was resisting a lot of things. So it had to be strong, you know? But this one really doesn't have much to prove. And it's so nice. That itself is a lesson. Freedom is softer, you know? Like, true freedom is soft.
True freedom is soft. Just listen.
So what do you think the role of music is in this time, participating in it, expressing?
I mean, it's when you're in music, you're always like dealing with Ethiopia, you know, first of all. So you have to learn, we learned every tribe's music, regardless of whether we're from that tribe or not, you know?
In Ethiopia, there are over 80 tribes and distinct languages with hundreds of dialects. At that moment, there was a lot of rising tension around tribal identity, even as Prime Minister Abiy was pushing for more unity.
So I think music can really speak to that unity and also like speak against whatever. There's always some thought that's trying to dominate and be like, okay, it's our turn, or the oppression was done on a tribal basis, so now the solution wants to appear tribal too. I don't know. Every day is a little tense because, you know, it could erupt into like, you know, tribe against tribe kind of violence if like 3-4 wrong moves happen, you know? We're all praying.
That was 2 years ago in 2019. This past month, I talked to Jorka again, but there was a very different feeling in the air. Because in November 2020, Prime Minister Abiy, the same leader who brought so much optimism and reform to Ethiopia, ordered a military offensive against the Tigray regional government in the north of the country. This was after the Tigray regional government attacked an Ethiopian military base. But the roots of this conflict go back years, if not decades. Before Abiy came into office, the leaders of that same regional government had dominated Ethiopian politics for over 25 years, even though they represented a small ethnic minority. With Abiy, all that changed, and tensions between the central government and the Tigray government have been escalating ever since, especially this past year.
I think the first real shock was the political assassination of a singer. You know, we've never seen that. Like, musicians were never targeted.
The singer Haçalu Hundessa was from the Oromo tribe, the largest ethnic group in Ethiopia. And his murder sparked immediate outrage.
It's just the ethnic identity becomes stronger than the national one, you know?
Right.
And so, like, that's a strange thing, you know? Like, suddenly, you know, an era you've been living in for a long time suddenly says you're a foreigner, you know? Like, you don't belong here, kind of. Mm-hmm. That's what's been going on. Pretty much, I have a funny story. You know, every house had to, like, volunteer an adult male to go out and patrol the neighborhood.
Oh, wow.
So everybody came up with sticks, and the only strong thing I had was a mic stand, you know? So here I was, like, at midnight with a mic stand amongst people carrying knives and sticks, and so I represented my profession well.
You're a living metaphor in that moment.
Absolutely.
So I was wondering if you could walk us through, like, a typical day for you as an artist right now.
Okay, well, right now, most of my time is in the studio. And the project that we've been working on is called Music Awi. And it's kind of like a tiny desk concert concept.
This past fall, just as tensions between the Ethiopian government and the Tigray regional government were reaching a boiling point, Jorga was producing a whole series of these videos. There are over 20 of them in different styles and featuring artists from all over the country.
It was kind of therapeutic because there was so much tribal tensions, ethnic mm-hmm. tensions. And here I was in the studio, like, booking one ethnic group after another, you know? The studio's on the 7th floor, and there's a balcony, like, right outside the studio. So while one group was being recorded, the others were dressing and rehearsing outside, you know? So you can hear music from Oromia, from Tigray, from Wolaita, Konta, Amharic, Gondar. So all this energy was just right outside on that balcony at the same day. You know, so we did videos and we tried to do concerts. So sometimes it feels good and sometimes it feels very like a drop in the bucket, like just maybe it's too late, you know, not too late, but like it takes time, you know.
Yeah, it's hard to know what your role is when there's that level of just uncertainty.
I'm focusing on the purity of music, you know, just on beauty and producing for like somebody who's like 5 years old now, who would be 15, 10 years from now, you know, like just keeping the future in mind.
Like sowing the seeds of unity.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and it's a prayer, you know, it's a deep prayer that hopefully like music would bypass the mind and talk directly to the heart, you know, like catching it while we can, you know, while it's still available, you know, while people still feel like singing.
Or in Jorga's case, playing. The conflict in Tigray broke out on November 4th, 2020, immediately after Election Day in the United States. That week in San Francisco, I was glued to the television, anxiously watching, waiting, as we inched closer and closer to the moment when we would know the name of our next president. And all the while, my heart was breaking, watching Ethiopia slip into war. Because with war, we know that people who had nothing to do with the conflict will suffer. Innocence is no shield. Calls for unity can feel impossible when history has not been reconciled. But the cost of not looking each other in the eye, it also feels too heavy to bear. How do we move through this? Like Jorga, I often find it easier to face these impossible questions as an artist, with music rather than with words. We use music to talk about the things that are hard to talk about. And there are millions of artists around the world doing just that. I try to focus on them, helping us imagine new futures, talking directly to our hearts, even as they continue to break.
That's Ethiopian-American singer Meklit Hedero, part of our ongoing series about the lives and work of immigrant musicians called Movement. It's produced by Ian Koss and Meklit, edited by Julie Kane. To learn more about Movement, just go to theworld.org. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. The Me Too movement had a mixed reception in France, but now it's having a second wave with a different focus than the first. Thousands of survivors of incest and child sexual abuse are sharing their stories on social media. France is the only EU country that does not have an age of consent law, making it harder to convict perpetrators. As Rebecca Rossman reports, activists hope this newfound momentum will change that. And a warning here, this story includes references to sexual violence against minors. Please take care while listening with others around you.
Julie was 13 years old when she had a seizure at school. A young firefighter brought her to the hospital. Later, he asked for her number, then shared it with his colleagues, who started contacting her. Julie says what followed was 2 years of sexual assault and gang rape by 20 firefighters.
Elle a été violée durant deux années.
Julie's mother, Corinne Lariche, has been telling her daughter's story. By the way, Julie is not the victim's real name. She uses a pseudonym for her protection. After diving into a serious depression, in which she made several suicide attempts, Julie confided to her mom about the ongoing abuse. By then, she was 15. When they went to press charges, Lariche says the officers suggested the relationships were consensual.
La première réaction de la police.
The initial reaction from the police was that we shouldn't believe that Julie was raped. They said that she wanted all of this to happen to her.
A judge later took the same position. French law criminalizes sex with a minor under the age of 15 unless the relationship is consensual, creating a gray area in the law that makes it difficult to convict perpetrators.
Julie, c'était une enfant de la République qui a été violée par 20 militaires.
Julie was a child of the French Republic, raped by 20 military men. If the justice system recognizes this fact, it will become a state scandal. The state has done everything to cover it up.
Earlier this week, France's highest appeals court heard arguments on whether all 20 firefighters should be charged with rape. A decision is expected next month. Meanwhile, hundreds of feminist activists have held rallies in support of Julie. The case comes as France faces a second Me Too reckoning. The country's first wave in 2017 was known as Balance ton porc, or squeal on your pig. The reaction was mixed, even skeptical. But there has been a lot more acceptance around this latest reckoning, which is centered mostly around cases of child sexual abuse and incest. It started last month when Camille Kouchner, a lawyer from a prominent French family, published a memoir accusing her stepfather, Olivier Duhamel, of sexually abusing her twin brother when he was a minor.
Moi, j'ai pris conscience que les choses n'étaient pas normales.
Duhamel is a well-known political scientist and former president of the board that oversees the prestigious Sciences Po University. He resigned shortly after the allegations came out.
L'inceste, l'emprise, la maltraitance des enfants.
In an interview with French television, Kouchner said her goal was to create awareness. There are victims of incest and child abuse all around us, she said.
Avec un mot-clé, le hashtag #MeTooInceste, des victimes d'inceste qui en quelques
thousands began sharing personal stories of incest and child abuse using the hashtag #MeTooInceste. Alice Coffin is a feminist activist and member of the Paris City Council.
For a few days now, there's been an accumulation of a story published in the papers targeting men of power.
The dominoes are falling. A series of high-profile politicians, academics, and others within France's elite have resigned from their posts in recent weeks. Some have been accused of abuse, others accused of helping cover up the abuse of their peers. Coffin says victims and activists are gaining more power, but she says it's not enough.
The other way to see it is how the structures of power in France are not moving. And I'm talking there about the very, very top.
Coffin is talking about members of French President Emmanuel Macron's own cabinet, including the interior minister who is under investigation for rape and the justice minister who criticized the initial Me Too movement for, quote, going too far. That's why Coffin, a former journalist, says there needs to be more women in positions of political power.
C'est aujourd'hui à nous.
Macron, for his part, last month published a video promising tougher laws on child sexual abuse.
Tout faire pour arrêter maintenant les violences sur nos enfants.
While no formal changes to the law have been made yet, France's justice minister announced plans to establish an age of consent at 15 years old. Any adult having sex with a minor under 15 would be considered rape. Corinne Lariche hopes this will make a difference for her daughter Julie.
Les pompiers l'ont transformé en objet. Ils l'ont en objet sexuel.
These firefighters transformed my daughter into a sexual object. They dehumanized her. And now the French justice system needs to give our daughter back her dignity.
If the court refuses to charge the 20 firefighters with rape, Lariche says she plans to take the case to the European Court of Justice. Only then, she says, can Julie's voice truly be heard. For the world, I'm Rebecca Rossman.
Seiko Hashimoto has competed in 7 Olympic Games as both a cyclist and a speed skater. In fact, she won a bronze medal for Japan in 1992 for skating. Now she'll be leading the Games. Hashimoto is named today as the president of the organizing committee for the Tokyo Olympics, scheduled for the summer. I have a very heavy responsibility, she said at a press conference today. I take it seriously. Previously, Hashimoto was Japan's Olympic minister. In her new post, she becomes one of the few women in prominent positions at the Games. The executive board of the Tokyo Organizing Committee is 80% male. And her appointment comes on the heels of a big embarrassment for the committee. Hashimoto's predecessor, former Japanese Prime Minister Yoshiro Mori, recently came under fire for making sexist comments, including saying women talk too much during meetings. Mori resigned last week. He said my inappropriate remarks caused turmoil, adding he was sincerely sorry. Seiko Hashimoto faces big challenges in her new role. The Tokyo Games have already been delayed by a year because of the pandemic, and polls say 8 in 10 people in Japan want the Games postponed again or even canceled. Hashimoto says a focus of her job will be keeping the Games safe and secure. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. When we're not here, we're online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We're back with you tomorrow.